what you're here for.
We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Trouble.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
Yes, Toronto, this is Steve. I am here, Radio Basics, CHRY 105.5. Do not tune out, people. We got some important news coming up. Radio Basics, as always, bringing the news every 2 weeks here on CHRY 105.5. Tonight, we're going to be speaking about the QP strike here on York University's campus. We're going to be speaking with the chair of QP 3903, Christina Rousseau. And we'll be putting the strike into its appropriate context, talking about the ongoing economic crisis in this country and across the world. We're also going to be speaking about, you know, putting into the context of labor mobilization and labor militancy in Canadian history, touching upon one important instance of labor mobilization in Canadian history. And with our music tonight on Radio Basics, we're going to be switching it up from today's Music of the Masses, hip-hop, and we're going to be playing yesterday's Music of the Masses. We're going to be playing a little bit of folk music, and we're going to see how the history of labor and struggle is represented in folk music, particularly, of course, in the North American context. And that's it. That's what we got for your show tonight. And the end of the show, also, we're going to be bringing on a special guest from No One Is Illegal, who's going to be talking about a high school students conference that is happening next week. Yeah, and that's about that. So without further ado, let's get this show going. As many of you are well aware, over the last few months, not a day has gone by when we haven't heard about the current economic crisis going on in Canada and across the world. Yet, as much as has been said about this crisis, so little has been said about how the economic crisis currently unfolding is a crisis of capitalism, a crisis of the richest of the rich, and how this crisis in particular is being borne out unnecessarily onto the poor, onto the workers, and even onto the middle class. For months now, financial institutions from across the world, especially in the United States, have been failing. First, there was Bear Stearns. Then there was Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, AIG, Washington Mutual, and soon perhaps even General Motors may fail. And yet over the same period, we saw the U.S. government time and time again run to the rescue of these financiers, dumping trillions of dollars of assets into these failing institutions. The same pattern has been repeated across the world among all the major capitalist countries. Such transfers of wealth from public to private institutions across the world has amounted to the greatest and most rapid transfer in wealth from the poor to the rich than in any other time in world history. In America, a rise of popular anger swept over the country as the U.S. government bailed out Wall Street institutions, plunging George Bush's approval ratings to the lowest levels for any president in U.S. history. And yet, both presidential candidates, Obama and McCain, not surprisingly, supported these bailouts, which has so much hurt the American people and have benefited the already rich. In Canada so far, the effects of the economic crisis have been felt with the wholesale loss of manufacturing jobs, reaching tens of thousands of jobs across the country. And while for some time the Canadian government told us that Canada was not America and that we would not be affected in the same way, today, November 12th, the Canadian government announced its own bailout package, one that is pretty much at par with the levels pledged by other capitalist governments around the world. Today, Canadian Finance Minister Jim Flaherty announced that the federal government would be buying up an additional $50 billion in mortgage debt from Bay Street. That's in addition to the $25 billion already pledged a few weeks ago. By the end of December, the Canadian government will have handed over more than $75 billion in Canadian people's money to private banks. This move is in addition to the massive support the Canadian government has already pledged to banks in late October 2008, when it promised to guarantee more than $200 billion in bank debt, which essentially means that if these debts fail to return, the Canadian government, or more precisely the Canadian people, will pick up the bill. While all those debts that don't fail and continue to rake in profits will, of course, conveniently be kept by the banks. As America's subprime mortgage scheme has already showed us, the crisis we are now facing is a result of banks recklessly lending out money and taking on bad debts that they knew that their debtors would not be able to pay off in the long run. Although this may seem like a stupid move for banks, that is, to lend out money that they knew would not come back to them, based on the massive amounts of money the public has been robbed of and given to private interests over the last few weeks and few months, it's pretty safe to assume that this was likely the plan all along. While the Canadian government and Canadian banks are pleading with Canadians to tighten their belts and accept the inevitable, Canadians need to start seeing these moves for what they really are. They are an economic attacks on the Canadian working class, which are probably greater than most living Canadians today are able to remember. So to summarize, Canadian banks, like the American banks, have been recklessly lending out money and loans. I mean, who doesn't know this? Credit card companies pushing higher and higher credit limits onto you, which you didn't even ask for. And now that these debts are failing, Canadians, regular Canadians, are having to foot the bill. Western governments have been telling their citizens that these financial institutions are too large and thus too important to be allowed to fail. So while hundreds of thousands and millions of people from around the world are losing their jobs, not to mention going bankrupt and losing everything they own, we must realize that it's not these people who are being bailed out. It's the banks, the insurance companies, and other financial institutions of the like, and soon, likely, automobile industries as well. All this money, trillions of dollars for who? Capitalists, financial institutions, those who already have most of the money in the world. And while all of this money could be used to build public institutions with secure jobs, unimaginable amounts of money are being poured into these failing institutions so that they can keep on doing what they know how to do, all they know how to do, which is to make profit. And of course, in capitalism, profit always comes before the people. Now, moving along somewhat in our show, we want to talk about history and the history of labor resistance to capitalism and the effects of capitalism on the vast majority of the people. History shows us that when capitalism cannot generate the profits that it needs, that is to say, when it enters into crisis, as we are now in, the first line of attack is always on workers. And so, in any capitalist system, you will find that economic crises always lead to attacks on the working class, and that those attacks often generate fierce resistance and revolutionary movements, even, from the workers. Today, we'll be looking at the ongoing strike at York University by education workers at QP 3903. But before we do that, let's take a brief look at one of the most, important instances of workers' resistance here in Canada, which is the Winnipeg General Strike of 1919. In the spring of 1919, with Winnipeg employers refusing to negotiate with organizing workers who wanted higher wages and union recognition, the workers turned to the Winnipeg Trades and Labor Council, the WTLC, for help. And within a week, a vote was held in which over 11,000 members of the WTLC chose to hold a general strike in solidarity with the building and metal workers' demands. On May 15, 1919, at 11 a.m., the general strike began with approximately 30,000 workers participating in a general strike that lasted almost 6 weeks. As word of the general strike spread across the country, workers in other areas declared their solidarity. Sympathy strikes were called in Brandon, Calgary, Edmonton, Saskatoon, Prince Albert, Regina, Vancouver, New Westminster, Victoria, and in as many as 20 other cities and towns across Canada. The response of the federal government to the Winnipeg strikers was similar to what we might expect today. Members of the federal parliament refused to meet with WTLC or the Central Strike Committee, but instead met only with a committee formed by employers, business elites, and the media. The federal government then ordered all workers back to work under the threat of being fired. On June 6, 1919, the federal cabinet changed the Immigration Act to allow for the arrest and deportation of quote-unquote enemy aliens. Workers not born in Canada were targeted as agitators and publicly referred to as alien scum. On June 17th, 12 strike leaders and strikers born in other countries were arrested and held in Stone Mountain Penitentiary just outside of Winnipeg, with some of them eventually being deported. Workers and strike supporters were outraged and planned a parade and a rally on Saturday, June 21st, 1919, now known as Bloody Saturday. The Royal Northwest, the Royal Northwest Mounted Police, known today as the RCMP, were used by the government to break up the crowds, which they did by killing one worker and seriously injuring at least 30 others. A special police force put together by the City of Winnipeg and the Canadian Army then beat many more workers using baseball bats and other blunted weapons. The militancy set off in Canada amongst workers for almost 30 years after the Winnipeg General Strike eventually resulted in many of the social gains that we know today, which were achieved by the mid-century, such as union recognition, collective bargaining rights, and social welfare programs for unemployed workers. The history of workers' struggle, which was the most militant in the first half of the 20th century, has reverberated down the ages to the present, and in particular has been timelessly captured in the history of folk music here in North America, which is something we want to talk about here today on the program. Just like hip-hop today, folk music over the greater part of the 20th century was the music of the masses, and thus has reflected many of these great labor struggles of the century. So on our show today, we want to take a look at a few of these incredible folk classics, which reflect these struggles in the early part of the century. And the first song that we want to turn to is known as is called Bread and Roses. Bread and Roses is a song which has been sung countless numbers of times over the last 100 years by countless folk singers and other artists, and it comes from a poem by American writer James Oppenheim entitled Bread and Roses from 1911. The poem came to be associated with a pivotal textile workers' strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts in 1912, whose workers were mostly immigrants and women. The strike, known as the Bread and Roses strike today, was led by the Industrial Workers of the World, which was a union led by communists, anarchists, socialists, and other radicals of the in the beginning of the 20th century, whose slogans included Workers of the World Unite and One Big Union. The legacy of the slogan Bread and Roses has been left with us down to present times. For instance, in Canada alone, we have a housing cooperative in Kitchener, Ontario, named Bread and Roses. And in Hamilton, at the Sky Dragon Center, there's a fair trade cafe known as Bread and Roses. And Bread and Roses is also the title of a Ken Loach film from 2000 about two Mexican laborers in Los Angeles. So, without further ado, let's get this song going. Just going to cue it up. That's Bread and Roses, once again, a poem by James Oppenheim, sung by Healy and Jurevich. Sorry, folks, can't seem to get that song queued up. So for now, let's proceed to one of the next folk songs that I was hoping to have here tonight.
When the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run, there can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever, solidarity forever, solidarity forever, for the union makes us strong. Is there aught we hold in common with the greedy parasite who would lash us into serfdom and would crush us with his might? Is there anything left to us but to organize and fight? For the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
plowed the prairie, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. We stand outcast and starve amidst the wonders we have made, but the Union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the Union makes us strong. All the world that's owned by idle drones is ours and ours alone. We have laid the wide foundation, built it skyward stone by stone. It is ours not to slave in, but to master and to own, while the Union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the Union makes us strong. They have taken untold millions that they never toiled to earn, but without our brain and muscle, not a single wheel can turn. We can break their haughty power, gain our freedom when we learn that the Union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever.
Welcome back, Toronto, CHRY 105.5. This is Steve on Radio Basics. Before the commercial there, you heard the song Solidarity Forever. Solidarity Forever, it was sung by folk legend Utah Phillips. And this song was originally written by Ralph Chaplin in 1915 and is probably one of the most famous workers' anthems ever, second only to perhaps the Internationale. Solidarity Forever was written as a song for the International Workers of the World, which we discussed a little earlier, and has been sung and recorded by many famous folk singers ever since, including Pete Seeger, Anne Feeney, Ella Jenkins, and tons of others. The lyrics in the song were about the power of community and solidarity, and it speaks to the notion that when people organize and come together, no matter how powerless they feel alone, there is great power in solidarity. Solidarity Forever has been sung repeatedly on the front lines of the QP 3903 strike here at York University, by QP3903's very own band, struck up for the purposes of the strike. It's been quite incredible. A week ago today, on November 5th, at this very moment, well over 500, perhaps even more, QP3903 members were crowding into a cramped Curtis Lecture Hall here at York University, fiercely debating the merits of going on strike against York University, their employer, and what issues would be the most prioritized if that strike should commence. At 10:39 p.m., the crowd in Curtis Hall erupted into a great cheer as union members voted overwhelmingly in favor of a strike, with 72% of people present in the present membership in the room rejecting York University's offer. Instantly, the media began to challenge the QP3903's right to strike based on the fact that 50,000 students were being shut out of school. However, the story that has not been told in the mainstream media is how the university has recklessly negotiated with 3903 in bad faith for months now. And tonight we have with us on the phone Christina Rousseau, the chair of QP3903. Christina, are you with us?
Hi, Steve. I'm here.
Hi, great. Thank you for being on the show with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So, I mean, I don't know where to start, really. There are a lot of misconceptions about what's happening with the strike. Perhaps you can start by telling us some of the main reasons why QP3903 has decided to go on strike.
Well, some of the major reasons revolve around, I know a lot of emphasis has been put on wage demands, but I mean, it really does extend far beyond that. And one of the primary issues that we're striking over is job security for our contract faculty members. There are people working at York. Our members of our local do over 50% of the teaching at York. Contract faculty members have to reapply for their jobs every semester. Even people who've been working here for over 20 years, every year they have to reapply for their job. So they have no job security. They also teach sometimes double the course load of what tenured faculty teach, but for a fraction of the pay. So we see this as something that's very inequitable and wrong with the university system, that so much reliance is being placed on on contract workers these days. Another major issue that we're on strike for is the restoration of our funding. So issues around health benefits, professional development, child care, and things like that. Mm-hmm. Those kind of funds. There were set amounts in 2005 that we won in our 2005 round of bargaining, and there's not been any increase to those funds, even though there's been about a 28% increase in our membership since then.
Hold on. So are you saying that was a fixed amount of benefits money that, although the membership has increased, swelled by almost one-third, that the money hasn't increased?
That's correct. So, like, to look at our extended health benefits fund, for example. So this pays for things like chiropractic work, physiotherapy, psychotherapy. This fund used to be able to pay out to our members at 100%, and now we're often only able to pay out at 40%. So members are not seeing the kind of funding that they need. And this is compounded, of course, with a very low wage to begin with. So most of our members live well below the poverty line, but also there's not extra support funds available for our members. So, mm-hmm. And these are issues that the university's not been willing to address with us.
Now, let me ask you a question. This is a point that the media has been hammering QP3903 on in the media.
Mm-hmm.
The media is claiming that, you know, QP3903, it's ridiculous for your union to be asking for a poverty level wage of a full-time worker when QP3903 members are only working part-time. How does the union respond to that challenge?
Right. Well, I mean, first we have to look at the fact that as the members of our local who are graduate students are only allowed to work 10 hours a week. So we're not choosing to work 10 hours a week. We could actually lose our status as graduate students and be kicked out of our programs if we work more than 10 hours. Obviously, some people are forced to go ahead and work, find outside employment, and take this risk. And this is not something that's unique to York. Graduate students are not allowed to work more than 10 hours. So that's one thing. And also, we have to look at the work that we do as graduate students. So when we do research, when we present at conferences, when we publish articles in journals, I mean, this is all work that directly benefits the university. York University has seen a very large increase in graduate enrollment in the past couple of years. And I think that this is a direct result of the great academic work that graduate students at York do. So this extra work that graduate students do is not acknowledged. And you also look at our members who get outside funding. So if you, or I guess they're not our members anymore. So, for example, if you're someone who receives SHRC, you are not eligible for a TA ship. If you get OGS, part of your funding from York is cut, so you'd only be eligible for half a TA ship. So, so even when external funding is given, any funding that York would give is taken away. So we're kind of stuck at this base wage that kind of have no way out of.
Mm-hmm. Is it not true that some of the workers are indeed actually a lot of the workers are actually working far more than 10 hours a week?
Definitely. We're only paid for 10 hours of work.
Yeah.
But there's definitely people, most people work far beyond the 10 hours. I mean, the university, you know, expects you to be able to mark, you know, a large paper in what they see as like a very small amount of time. And but they also don't give you the proper training to be able to do this, right? So they say that this work can be done in 10 hours, but in reality, it takes far, far much more time.
Yeah, and then, I mean, just recalling my experience as an undergraduate student, it can become very frustrating as an undergraduate student when you get back a paper that has no comments on it, a grade at the end, and, you know, a couple little check marks or X's, and you don't know what the hell's going on. You don't know what you've been evaluated upon.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, just even the writing of the comments, which I think is really essential for undergraduates to be able to improve their work. That takes up, you know, a lot of time. Writing a comment, something substantial on every paper, that takes up a lot of time, far more than, you know, putting a couple of check marks and an A or B at the end.
Now, what are some of the other demands that QP3903 is asking for?
Well, we're looking for demands around employment equity, reduction of class sizes. We're really looking to address issues that will affect the quality of education at York University. One of the things that we're asking for is for the university to address the issue of tuition fees.
Mm-hmm.
As a bargaining unit, we can only demand things or bargain for things that affect our members. But we see that if we make these changes, that this is something that can affect the university as a whole because it sets precedent. We'd also like to see an abolition of the studenthood of conduct for our members. The student code of conduct doubly penalizes someone. It basically makes you accountable for things that you would already be accountable for under the law. So people are judged twice. And I mean, there are a number of students, former students of York University who have been penalized under the student code of conduct who have lifetime bans from York University, are not allowed to step foot on York University property for the rest of their lives, mm-hmm. simply for expressing their political voice. And we see this is something that is really wrong and should not be happening in Canada. We say that we have freedom of speech, but really we don't. So
now there's another demand that I know the union holds very dear to their heart, and that's the ability to be able to renegotiate their contract in 2010.
That's right.
Now something, I'm not sure if you were listening to the show prior to coming on to it, but one thing we've been talking about through the show is this great economic crisis that Canada is currently going through. And we've been looking at how the Canadian government is massively, massively subsidizing, to the tune of tens of billions of dollars, private financial institutions. And we were talking about on our show how that shows, that illustrates to us, to Canadians, regular Canadians, that there is no lack of money out there in the system of public funds to fund public institutions. So I'm just interested to know, how does that relate to that issue to be able to renegotiate in 2010?
Right. I mean, yeah, people keep on citing that these are hard economic times. We have to look at the fact that when there is an economic downturn, there's an increased enrollment in universities. The reason that we're really committed to renegotiating in 2010 is because we're looking to join with other local university locals in Ontario, to go into coordinated bargaining, so that we can put pressure not only on our own individual universities, but to also really pressure the government to put more funding into universities, funding not only for graduate students, but for undergraduates as well. We want to see more funding. We want to see an abolition of tuition. We want to see education that is accessible for all Canadian citizens. No one should be denied the right to education just because of their economic status.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And I mean, I guess there was a huge announcement in the Canadian press today that the Canadian government will now be giving upwards and around $75 billion to buy bad mortgage debts from Canadian banks. So, I mean, this is just an unbelievable amount of money. I mean, if they have $75 billion for private institutions that regular Canadians are going to pay for, how come they don't have money to pay our workers better, to pay for education and whatnot, right?
Exactly. It really makes no sense. You look at the things that our society claims to value, things like education, and then to really see where funding is going from the government, I don't think it reflects what we value as a society at all.
Now, so can you tell us can you recount the events leading up to the strike? York University's negotiations with you, why did this have to result in strike? Why couldn't it be averted by other means?
Right, I mean, if you can call what they've been doing negotiations, we've been bargaining with them since July. Since then, their first concrete proposal to us came on September 16th. So their first actual proposal came on September 16th, where they initially offered us the 2% wage increase. At this time, the same time that they offered us this 2% wage increase, they also called for binding arbitration. So they offered us binding arbitration when they hadn't even been attempting to negotiate with us up to that point.
Can you explain this concept for our listeners?
Right. So binding arbitration basically is where a third party comes in, kind of looks at the perspective of both sides, and at that point is supposed to come to a fair agreement. Now, normally binding arbitration is only supposed to come in after you actually have been negotiating, and there's maybe one or two sticky issues left that you're not in agreement on. So York University had not been bargaining with us at all prior to offering binding arbitration. And actually, really confused as to why they are for binding arbitration. In a previous round of negotiations with the York University Faculty Association, so the York University Faculty Association that represents tenured professors at York,
mm-hmm.
The York University Faculty Association requested binding arbitration in a previous round of bargaining, and the York administration actually rejecting binding arbitration, and I can read to you why they rejected it. They said, arbitration risks handing over the future of the institution and the definition of a new contract for faculty to a third party who cannot possibly appreciate the subtleties and complexities of a university such as York. Engaging in arbitration on these issues is tantamount to allowing an outsider who has no continuing interest in or commitment to the university to have the authority to decide academic priorities for the institution. For UFA, as with other trade unions, the right of employees to withdraw their services is the ultimate method of resolving disputes. So it's really interesting to me that York is really pushing for binding arbitration at this time when, from what I've just said, from what they have said in their own words, is not the way that bargaining should be done. So after they asked for binding arbitration, they still have given us nothing. So they initially gave us the 2% offer, mm-hmm. and then the only other offer they gave after that was the 9.25 over 3 years that they offered us 2 days before we went on strike. Mm-hmm. So since July, two offers. Now, I don't call that bargaining. I don't call that negotiating. I don't know what they call it
consider
that negotiations or bargaining, but that's not what I consider to be negotiating or bargaining.
Now, for the purpose of our listeners, can you break down what that 9-whatever% over 3 years actually means, and does it result in you know, like a substantial wage increase that would be acceptable to the union?
Right. Looking at the 9.25 over 3 years, so basically that only takes into account wages. So they've offered us 3% in the first year, 3.25% in the second year, and 3% in the third year of the contract. But that doesn't look at wages and benefits as a whole. So if you look at, if you also take benefits into account, so things like health benefits, child care funding, but also looking at leaves, so things like maternity leave or sick leave. If you look at that also with the wages that they've offered us, it actually ends up being 2.3% that they're offering us per year.
Okay.
When you take those factors into account. So, and looking at the rate of inflation in Toronto right now, it's well below the rate of inflation. Mm. If you look at inflation as being at 3.6 or 3.7, they're asking us basically to take a major rollback by offering us this 2.3% a year when you take wages and benefits together as a whole. So the 9.25 over 3 years that they're highlighting is simply with wages. So they're not taking into account these other things that we're asking for.
I see. So what you're saying is overall it amounts to a major concession on the part of the union.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Okay.
They're basically asking us to take less.
Now, can you give us a bit of an update for the purpose of our listeners and York University students out there? What's the state of negotiations right now?
Up until this point, we'd actually requested to meet with the university on Thursday. Initially, they had declined our offer, but we actually got word very late this evening that they have reconsidered and will now meet with us tomorrow at 3 p.m. They rent out a nice hotel for us to meet with them, so perhaps they could spend money on, settling an agreement rather than spending money on fancy hotels and expensive lawyers. But I guess that's where they see their money being spent right now.
All right. Is there anything else you'd like to add that we haven't covered so far?
That's about all that's been happening right now. I mean, unfortunately, there's not really much more to report. They've not given us a counter offer to what we've rejected.
Mm-hmm.
So our bargaining team right now is currently looking at our package, kind of reevaluating it and seeing where we should go from here. Just ask anyone who's listening to come out and join us on the picket lines this week. Pick up a banner, mm-hmm. pick up a flag, and come sing songs with us.
I heard that today was a great day on the picket lines.
Pardon?
I heard that today was a great day on the picket lines.
Yeah, today was a really great day on the picket lines. We had people come out and support us from groups like the CAW, from OPSU, PSAC, so different, and so many more that I can't even name right now. But so different unions across Toronto, different community groups came out and joined us on the picket lines and offered us messages of solidarity, also offered us financial donations for our hardship fund because, many of our members do live below the poverty line and cannot afford to be on strike. So other unions in Toronto recognize this and have graciously donated money to help support our members during this strike if and when they come into great financial need. So it's been really great. Everyone's spirits were really lifted today, so it's really nice to see everyone come out and join us.
Well, that's good to hear. Good luck, Christina. Thank you for being with us on the phone tonight.
Thanks, Steve.
All right.
Okay, bye.
That was Christina Rousseau from QP 3903 updating us on the current situation with QP 3903's strike and their ongoing, or actually negotiations, which are just about to begin tomorrow. Now, on the show tonight, we've been covering some of the greatest folk labor classics, music of the masses that have represented the long history of worker struggles in North America and in this country. We were trying to play for you Bread and Roses earlier today. We had some technical difficulties, but I have it now, so let's hear it.
Darkened kitchens, a thousand mil Oscar AI, touched with all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people here are singing bread and roses, bread and roses. Rising through our singing, their ancient cry for bread. Art, love, and beauty, their judging spirits knew. Yes, it is bread we fight for, but we fight for roses. Battle once again. We're fighting for our children, our sisters, and for men. Our lives shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread.
Radio Basics, we're back, Toronto. Before the commercial, you were listening to Bread and Roses, an important song that defined an era in the beginning of the 20th century, particularly related to the labor union, industrial workers of the world. The next song we have up for our listeners tonight is also a folk classic. It was written by Joe Hill, or Joel Emanuel Haglund, a migrant worker and an organizer of the industrial workers of the world, who wrote the labor song over a religious hymn as criticism of the way religion was being used as a way to discourage workers from organizing themselves. This song, The Preacher and the Slave, captures the essence of what laborers were being told by the church and the Salvation Army, or as IWW workers used to call it, the Starvation Army, which was that their bellies would be full in the afterlife in heaven, and thus that there was little need for organizing for better lives here in this mortal life. So this is Joe Hill's The Preacher and the Slave, sung by folk legend Joel Glazer.
long-haired preachers come out every night, try to tell you what's wrong and what's right. But when asked about something to eat, they will answer with voices so sweet, you will eat by and by, in the glorious land in the sky, way up high, work and pray, live on hay. You get pie in the sky when you die. And the Starvation Army, they play, and they sing and they clap and they pray, till they get all your coin on the drum. Then they tell you when you're on the bum, you will eat by and by, in the glorious land in the sky, way up high, work and pray, live on hay. You'll get pie in the sky when you die. Holy rollers and jumpers come out, and they holler and jump and they shout. But when eating time comes round, they say, you will eat on that glorious day. You will eat by and by, in the glorious land in the sky, way up high, work and pray, live on hay. You'll get pie in the sky when you die. If you fight hard for children and wife, try to get something good in this life, you're a sinner and bad man, they tell. When you die, you will sure go to hell. You will eat by and by, in the glorious land in the sky, way up high, work and pray, live on hay. You'll get pie in the sky when you die, that's a lie. Working men of all countries unite, together we'll stand and we'll fight. When the world and its wealth we have gained, to the grafters we'll sing this refrain. You will eat by and by, when you've learned how to cook and to fry. Chop some wood, do you good, and you'll eat in the sweet by and by. That's no lie.
Radio Basics, we're back. That was The Preacher and the Slave, also known as Pie in the Sky, termed by the original writer, Joe Hill, an organizer with the Industrial Workers of the World, who was eventually executed for his activism and his mobilizing, though his spirit certainly lives on in that song, as well as in the social rights that we had gained today through a long history of labor mobilization. Now, turning to migrants' rights and migrant struggles in this country, in Canada. We have on the air with us today Faria Khan of No One Is Illegal. No One Is Illegal, which is a pan-Canadian grassroots migrants' rights group, will be holding a high school students' conference called Beyond Borders. It will be taking place at the Ontario Institute for Studies and Education at 252 Bloor Street West from 9:30 a.m. to 3 p.m., once again, that's November 18th, next week. We have with us on the line Faria Khan. Faria, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, thank you for being with us again. So, tell us about No One Is Illegal and the work that you guys do.
So, as you mentioned, right now, we're a grassroots migrant rights activist organization, and we essentially fight for the rights of all people to reside in Canada. So, the idea is that everyone should have status upon landing in Canada. And also we organize against a lot of the regressive legislation that are anti-immigrant, explicitly against the working class people and the poor. And we also do a lot of work with marginalized communities in general to link up issues of migrant rights with other rights, with other movements, so that we understand that, you know, this is not just about migrant rights, but it's about the rights of all people to live and assert themselves and live a life of dignity and with respect.
Mm-hmm. Over the course of the show today, we've been talking about some of the economic bailouts that the Canadian government is currently implementing and buying off, you know, financial corporations to the tune of, you know, tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. And maybe you can speak about, over the course of the last year or two or in recent times, how migrant workers in particular have been affected by the Canadian state and by capitalism, and how has the crisis that we're experiencing at large, how is it particularly affecting migrant workers?
Absolutely. I think the biggest thing with this whole idea of the financial crisis and the way it's playing out in migrant communities in general is that with many of these types of issues, essentially migrant communities become the scapegoats and are problematized in the eyes of the state, right? So when we're seeing these whole ideas about financial crisis, immediately we see a backlash against migrant communities. Immediately we see a backlash against immigrants. Immediately we see a backlash against non-status workers. And essentially the argument that's put forward is, well, we don't have enough jobs because they're taking away our jobs, without the understanding that in a time of financial crisis, it's these types of communities that are actually targeted far more than any other community. Mm-hmm. So when we see these bailouts of these huge corporations, at the same time we see regressive legislation being put forth in attempt to clearly, you know, scapegoat migrants as the problem instead of saying, you know, there's deep economic problems that capitalism is to blame for. So one of the ways in which we can highlight that is if you see the introduction of Bill C-50, which was the Budget Implementation Act, and in it, essentially the government snuck in changes to the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, which is IRPA, and it was this huge mobilizing force on the government's part in terms of going into ethnic communities, and especially targeting ethnic media and saying, you know, this is a great piece of legislation. We want you to know that this is the answer to people gaining status who are undocumented in your communities. But what the legislation actually did was that it creates and exacerbates the very same problem that we're trying to address, which is the fact that temporary work is not a solution to full status. It's actually the problem. When people come here with temporary status, when they're working on temporary work permits, they essentially have no rights. They have no labor rights. So they can't unionize. Mm-hmm. They can't ask for better wages. If they complain, immediately the threat of detention and deportation is launched. Mm-hmm. So when we see, like, migrant workers in, for example, Windsor, there's documented cases now of, you know, people nearly going blind. And when they've actually complained about it, they're immediately deported to Mexico. Or we see live-in caregivers who have cancer. And when they find out that they have cancer, they're immediately deported back to the Philippines, right? Mm-hmm. And this is a general trend that we see that the government's supporting. And it's the same type of trend that kind of fuels our economy, right? Mm-hmm. Is that it's okay to exploit communities. It's okay to exploit migrant workers. It's okay to exploit people of color as long as, you know, corporations are benefiting. And somehow that's going to trickle down to all of us. Mm-hmm. And we're going to somehow, you know, come to this magical world where we're all happy and we all have a decent standard of living.
It's interesting that you mentioned those changes to the Immigration Act that came down last spring. Earlier in the show, we were talking about the changes to the Immigration Act that were passed during the Winnipeg General Strike of 1919 when, you know, those changes were used to attack migrant workers in Winnipeg and to create this new category of alien workers, which, you know, just justified the fierce repression that workers were facing back in 1919. So
absolutely, and it's the same type of trend that we're seeing today, right? Is that if you can pit worker against worker, then you don't have to, you know, grant people more rights, right? Because you can just use another group of people to scapegoat and say, we're not the problem. You know, shitty wages isn't the problem. You know, not having a good standard of living isn't the problem. Not having benefits isn't the problem. But somehow the problem is just racialized people who are taking their jobs.
Now, my apologies, Faria. We don't have much time left tonight. We only have about 30 seconds. Perhaps you can tell us about the conference that's happening next November 18th.
Sure. So Beyond Borders is a full-day conference for high school students to learn about and kind of discuss issues faced by immigrants and refugees and migrant communities in Canada. And it's with the understanding that through kind of participatory workshops, multimedia performances, we want to highlight not just the problems with Canada's immigration system and wider issues faced by migrants, but we also want to highlight issues faced by marginalized communities in general in Canada.
How can people register for the conference?
So registration right now has actually closed because we're up to 250. But
oh, wow.
We're going to do the same type of full day conference in hopefully around February. So
okay.
As soon as that comes out, we'll be in touch, and of course we'll give you all the contact information to register. But if you want to do registration for your classes, mm-hmm. and you want to have us come in and do workshops with your classes, you can just email us at NOIIstudent@gmail.com.
Faria Khan, thank you for being with us on the show tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
Keep strong.
Okay, take care.
That was Faria Khan of No One Is Illegal. To conclude our show tonight, we'll be going out with probably what is one of the most famous songs of all time. I think one would be hard-pressed to find a song that has been sung in more languages and by more people than this one. It's the greatest labor song of all times, The International. This song was written in 1871 in France, the year and place of the famous Paris Commune. Ever since, the song has been sung by revolutionary workers around the world. This is The International, sung by American folk legend Pete Seeger. I am Steve, Radio Basics. We're out.
De boule les dames de la terre, de boule les forces de la fin, la raison ton centre à terre, c'est l'éruption de la fin. Tout passé fait dans ta plaza, l'esclave debout, debout. Le monde va changer de base, nous ne sommes rien, soyons tout. C'est la lutte finale, reprends-nous et demain. L'internationale sera le genre humain, c'est le titre final, reprends-nous et demain. L'international sera le genre humain.